Today we're going to be looking at Joshua chapter 2. And this is the account of Joshua sending two spies to view the land, especially Jericho, and the experience they had while they were there. Verse 1. Now Joshua the son of Nun sent out two men from Acacia Grove to spy secretly, saying, "Go, view the land, especially Jericho." So they went and came to the house of a harlot named Rahab and lodged there. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, "Behold, men have come here tonight from the children of Israel to search out the country." So the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, "Bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the country." Then the woman took the two men and hid them. So she said, "Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And it happened as the gate was being shut when it was dark that the men went out. Where the men went, I do not know. Pursue them quickly, for you may overtake them." But she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them with the stalks of flax which she had laid in order on the roof. Then the men pursued them by the road to the Jordan, to the fords. And as soon as those who pursued them had gone out, they shut the gate. Now before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, "I know that the Lord has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now therefore I beg you, swear to me by the Lord, since I have shown you kindness, that you will also show kindness to my father's house and give me a true token and spare my father, my mother, my brothers, my sisters, and all that they have, and deliver our lives from death." So the men answered her, "Our lives for yours, if none of you tell this business of ours. And it shall be when the Lord has given us the land that we will deal kindly and truly with you." Then she let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was on the city wall. She dwelt on the wall. And she said to them, "Go to the mountain, lest the pursuers meet you. Hide there 3 days until the pursuers have returned. Afterward you may go your way." So the men said to her, "We will be blameless of this oath of yours which you made us swear. Unless, when we come into the land, you bind this line of scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down, and unless you bring your father, your mother, your brothers, and all your father's household to your own home. So it shall be that whoever goes outside the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be on his own head, and we will be guiltless. But whoever is with you in the house, his blood shall be on our head if a hand is laid on him. And if you tell this business of ours, then we will be free from your oath which you made us swear." Then she said, "According to your words, so be it." And she sent them away, and they departed. And she bound the scarlet cord in the window. They departed and went to the mountain, and stayed there 3 days until the pursuers returned. The pursuers sought them all along the way, but did not find them. So the two men returned, descended from the mountain, and crossed over. And they came to Joshua the son of Nun, and told him all that had befallen them. And they said to Joshua, "Truly the Lord has delivered all the land into our hands, for indeed all the inhabitants of the country are faint-hearted because of us." Now notice that this chapter, chapter 2 of Joshua, shows the faithfulness and the faith of a Canaanite named Rahab. And that's a great contrast to Achan's unfaithfulness in chapter 7, and he is an Israelite. Notice that this mission the spies were on was not really effective in terms of their plans. Their planned mission, Joshua sent them to spy secretly, and maybe they weren't well trained. I don't know what the deal was, but they were very quickly find out. The very next verse, the king knew about it. And it's also important to notice that it's not likely there was a sexual encounter of these two men at the harlot's house. It was a place where she was lodging people. And the wording does not word it in a way that would indicate that is the case, that they had a sexual encounter with her. It's also important to notice that there are very few details about the mission itself. And the focus is on what? The focus is on conversations with Rahab. Now, that's very instructive when you study a Bible passage, because often you'll have many verses devoted to one thing and then only a few devoted to something else. In terms of the amount of space that has been allocated, what does that tell you? The greater emphasis is on the part where lots of detail has been given. Notice the quick response of the king's messengers. You might wonder, why didn't they search the house? But you see what she told them? She told them that they left. And so evidently they thought, oh, they're just up the way just a little bit. If we rush out, we will be able to find them. And so they didn't question her more. Now, notice the faith that Rahab had here. She stood alone against her total culture. She rejected the seen for the unseen. She wasn't just saying, those Israelites must be powerful fighters. She was saying, we saw these events. We knew of these events. I mean, they didn't actually see the Red Sea open, of course. But they knew of those events. They thought about what that meant, and that there was a God that was operating on behalf of the Israelites that was vastly more powerful than the gods they were worshiping and the gods they were following. So how did she reject the seen for the unseen? She is deciding to follow this unseen God, and her action is she hid the spies in direct disobedience to the king, verse 4. She lied to cover for them, verse 4 and 5. She sent her own people on a wild goose chase. Now you can see God's providence. The messengers didn't bother to search the house. You know, there are other cases in the Bible where God is intervening in the midst of human beings trying to do what they want to do. You can read about it in Genesis 50, verse 20, for example, or 2 Samuel 17, verse 14. Anyway, notice her testimony. She says that she knew the Lord had given them the land. They had heard about God's miracles. They were frightened by the prospect of the Israelites coming. And she understood the supremacy of the Lord there in verse 11. And that was the real reason for fear. In fact, there are several reasons why her statement is remarkable. One is that she is saying Israel's God has dominion of vast scope, including the realms of the other gods. Notice verse 11. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. You see, he has rulership over a vast domain, both in heaven and on earth. In other words, his rulership includes rulership over these other gods. And then she also uses the name Yahweh. In some of your English Bibles, you'll have the word Lord in capital letters. For example, you see it there in verse 10 and also in verse 11. And when that occurs in a Bible that does this, that's referring to the special name of God in Hebrew called Yahweh. It's the name when Moses said, who shall I say sent me? And God said, tell him I am sent you. In other words, it's the personal name of God, this particular God. So she's identifying this God by name as Israel's God and declares him what? In verse 11, he is God. In other words, he is the real God, the true God. These other gods are false. And then she, of course, describes him as God in heaven and on earth. So here is her statement of faith. And notice she is a contrast to her own culture. I mean, she was persuaded by the facts she knew. Her countrymen had seen the same facts. She said in verse 9, I know the Lord has given you the land. But then what's the rest of verse 9? Terror has fallen on us. So those other people also knew that they were in bad shape. We have heard what the Lord did in drying up the Red Sea and what you did to the two kings, Sihon and Og. And our hearts melted. You see? They're terrified. So she was persuaded that this involves something far superior. Namely, this God is above all other gods. But her countrymen refused to be persuaded by those same facts. Now, in that regard, turn to Hebrews chapter 11, verse 31. It's talking about the episode at Jericho, beginning at verse 30. He says, by faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled for 7 days. And then verse 31, by faith the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe when she had received the spies with peace. Now, the words that are translated there, did not believe, the word that's translated, has to do with being persuaded. The Greek word is apatho. In the direct form of this word, it means to persuade. Patho means to persuade. And in the passive form, it means be persuaded. Now, sometimes it'll be translated in the passive form, obey. You see, if you are truly persuaded, you will obey. Well, this word is apatho. In other words, unpersuaded. You see, by faith, the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who refused to be persuaded. How did they refuse to be persuaded? They knew the same facts that Rahab knew. But they refused to be persuaded that this was the God of heaven and earth. This was the only true God, and it's the one you better ascribe allegiance to. You see, Rahab was a foreigner who responded in faith to a very threatening God. Now, in Matthew's genealogy, Rahab is mentioned along with four other women: Tamar, Ruth, Bathsheba, and Mary. And look at how there were foreigners in that list, not just Israelites. And this shows how the Abrahamic covenant was designed to include the nations. Remember, God said to Abraham in Genesis 12, verses 2 and 3, I will make you a blessing. And he talks about the nations, not just Abraham. Now, the Ninevites repented at the preaching of Jonah. And that suggests that God would have mercy on whoever repents. But notice, only Rahab seized it as an opportunity and not a disaster. You see, most of the people were looking at it, this is the disaster that's happening to us. This is terrible. How can we make it as little a disaster as possible? And what's Rahab doing? Rahab is seizing this as an opportunity to change allegiance to the real God. And notice, her family joined her. Now notice this also. True faith is always accompanied by works. It is not merely a mental understanding. I mean, after all, the devils also believe and what? Tremble. They have a mental understanding that God is going to judge the earth. And they tremble. But Rahab not only had a mental understanding, she took tremendous risks in what she did. And another verse in the New Testament, James 2, verse 25. It's talking about faith and works. And it says, likewise, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way? James, in his discussion, makes it very clear that faith without works is a dead kind of faith. If you have faith, many people talk about having faith, but their works are in opposition to God. That means they do not really have the kind of faith God requires. Because faith in God means you change your allegiance, and so you are actually in harmony with what God has to say. And so notice, she was counted by God as righteous for what she did. She took risks. In fact, she was a person who was willing to, in essence, lose her life in order to save it. And so she pled for herself and her family, and it seems that she became an effective evangelist. Because I doubt if they'd had discussions about this earlier. She's talking to these people, these two spies, and then she pleads for not only herself but her family. Well, evidently, she went out and talked to them about, here's the deal. Come join me. We can actually escape the judgment. And then she marks the house with that scarlet cord. Now, that scarlet cord to mark the house parallels the Passover lamb in a certain sense. Do you notice that what you have there is, if you stay in this house, you're safe. But if you leave, you're not safe. Remember, in the Passover, it was the same kind of deal. They had to put the blood on the lintels and the doorposts, and then everyone had to stay in the house. And if you stayed in the house, you were safe. Well, there's a parallel. And also, there's a parallel in relation to salvation. You have to stay in the house. You can't say, oh, well, I put the blood on there, fine, now I can walk out and do whatever I feel like. You stay in the house. Now, here's a question you can ask. Was it wrong for these two men to make a covenant with this foreigner? Hadn't God said, don't make any covenant with the people of the land? In fact, you remember they later on in Joshua, they made a covenant with the Gibeonites. And it was the wrong thing to do. And in the book of Judges, you have all these entanglements that Israel had with these other people. And what a disaster it was for them spiritually. What is different is Rahab's confession of her allegiance to God put her on the side of the Israelites. She was, in essence, becoming an Israelite in that process. She was renouncing her past. And so you see, it does not violate God's commandment. So what were the final actions here? She gives them advice on escaping pursuit. The natural way to capture these spies would have been to do what? Run to the Jordan and stay at the fords where they could get across, because they would naturally go back to their commander to give their information. Now, notice what happened. If you go back to verse 7, then the men pursued them by the road to the Jordan to the fords. And as soon as those who pursued them had gone out, they shut the gate. So they shut the gate so they can't get back into the city, because they thought they had left the city. And then they pursued them to the fords, because that's how they're going to get across to the because that's how they will get across the Jordan to go back to their commander. That's the natural thing. And what did she tell them to do? Go to the mountain. Where's the mountain? It's to the west. So you see, she knew that the pursuers would naturally go there, and rightfully so. And so she sent them, go out to the west and stay low until the pursuers have returned, and then go across. Then there was this agreement on sparing her family. And remember, that would require faith on their part. Why should we go to a house that's on the wall? That's a vulnerable place. And then, of course, there's this symbolism of safety only in the house. Well, what about their friends? Why are you staying there all the time? Just imagine, as the army is encircling around one day, they're sitting in the house. And then the next day, they're sitting in the house. And the next day, they're sitting in the house. They're friends. What are you doing there all the time? Well, we're tired of waiting here for 7 days. Now, if you think like Rahab, how would you be thinking? We don't know what they're doing, But we know that God is with them, and we better watch out. Now, when she tied that cord in the window, would that raise any suspicions? So, you see, we don't really know those kind of details. Maybe it was often that she had a cord tied in the window as an advertisement, here's where you could come for lodging. We don't know. If she did have that cord tied in the window, it would certainly have raised suspicions if she left it go all the way down to the bottom, because then someone could come back up that way. So my guess is it didn't reach that far, or she maybe didn't let it drape down that far after she let them down. You know, these are questions that you can ask, and we don't really know the answer to. And what does it tell you about this account? As far as this account is concerned, it is not important. See, these are not the details that are important. When you look at the account, what does it emphasize? It emphasizes the conversation that she has with these men, not the exact procedures they went through, how they went and found her house in the first place, on and on and on and on. What happened to that cord? How long did she let it stretch down? Did she ever set one out there before? Those kind of questions are not important. The real issue is what was going on in her mind and what was going on in the minds of her countrymen, and how she was turning her allegiance to this God of this other nation. Now notice, when the spies got back, what did they tell Joshua? They gave testimony how that God had already prepared the way for the conquest. You see, the spies had faith. You know, it's not if something happens, it's what. Truly, the Lord has delivered all the land into our hands, for indeed all the inhabitants of the country are faint-hearted because of us. So what is the strategic value of the spy mission? Not military details at all. It's that the faith of the whole community could be strengthened. Now, obviously, that is a military advantage, because if you have all of your warriors gung-ho and knowing that God is going to vindicate their cause and give them victory, that's very helpful. But in terms of military strategy, there was no detail, apparently, that was of any particular value. It was that God took them through this thing not to accomplish something great, but to increase their faith and to increase the faith of the community. You know, sometimes God takes us through things that don't seem to accomplish anything and seem to have no value, in fact, almost seem detrimental on the surface. But what is God's purpose in these things? It is to increase our faith. I think this passage also illustrates God's higher thoughts. You know, in Isaiah it says that as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my thoughts higher than your thoughts, and my ways than your ways. And I've often traced through biblical history and shown many, many cases where God was having much higher thoughts than the people could have imagined who were believers going through perplexity on the earth, as he was accomplishing much greater things. Now see that here in this case as well. Joshua would not have known about Rahab. He would not have known what was going through her mind. And so God was accomplishing something far greater and far higher than a fact-finding mission before a military operation. He was accomplishing a spiritual harvest of Rahab and her family. And she was actually incorporated into the lineage of Christ. So what are some lessons that we need to learn from this chapter? You know, when we are really doing the will of God, there will be people who see the power of God operating in your life. They'll see things going on that shows that God is with you. And sometimes God will bring us into difficult circumstances so that we will be willing to meet somebody else's need. You know, sometimes we are just naturally so selfish that unless we go through some difficulty, we are not inclined to go out of our way to meet someone else's need. And God was actually arranging an opportunity for the salvation of Rahab. And it's interesting, too, that Rahab did not delay in her obedience in relation to that cord. She bound that thing right in the window. You just thought, well, I'll get around to it when we see the army coming, you know, then I'll do it. You know, if you're really concerned about the things of God, you are going to be diligent about it, just like the passage in Peter talks about there in 2 Peter chapter 1. Giving diligence to adding these things so that you can have an abundant entrance into the eternal kingdom. Notice also how that Rahab unselfishly asked for others also, and it shows God's generosity. You see, once Rahab had that verbal contact with believers, that verbal contact, then she was even more sure of her position. And she talked to her family about it. Now, this question, was it wrong for Rahab to lie? That's a very good question because it comes up again and again. There are three basic positions that Christians have held on this subject. One is that there are things in life, because we live in a fallen world, where you have two evil things and you choose between the lesser of two evils. In other words, one thing would be acting in a way that causes these two men to be killed. The other thing would be telling a lie so that they're not killed. Which do you do? And so some people say, well, here's how you deal with it. The lesser of the two evils would be to simply tell the king a lie or his messengers a lie so that these men can escape. So you save their life just by telling a lie. Then you can repent of that afterwards. So then you ask God to forgive you for telling a lie. That's one position. Well, you know, there's a very simple answer to this. Jesus would have encountered on this earth various dilemmas. And we know that Jesus never sinned, and so Jesus would never have taken this option. He would have never decided, okay, here's two things, so I'll sin on the lesser of these, and then ask God to forgive me. The second option that people sometimes use is an idea of what you might call graded absolutes. You know, there are some moral commands, there are some commands in Scripture that are of greater import than other commands. Now, sometimes people might say, well, all of God's commands are important. That's true. But it's very clear that even Jesus realized some commandments are greater than other ones. When he was asked, what is the greatest commandment? He said, it's to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second is like unto it, love your neighbor as yourself. On these two hang all the law and the prophets. So that means these two commands are superlative. There's one above all others, and then there's the next one, and then all the rest hang on those things. So some people say, well, since some absolutes have higher priority than others, in those cases, the believer is not required to obey the lower priority command when there is a conflict. And so you disobey the lower priority command in order to attain a higher good. Well, again, would Jesus have done that? The answer is no, because we know Jesus never sinned. He was never going to be breaking one of God's commands in order to fulfill another one. The third position is that God gives non-conflicting absolutes. That means that both commands are to be obeyed. So you're to try to help preserve someone's life, but at the same time refuse to lie. In other words, there's going to always be a way that avoids sin. We never say the ends justify the means. Many people say that. But you know what happens? When people say the end justifies the means and they use corrupt means to produce the right ends, that corrupt means actually corrupts the ends also. We don't take the notion that Paul described in Romans 3, 7, and 8, let's do evil that good may come. I mean, for example, Rahab could have said, well, you can search my house if you want to. That would have been a true statement. She wouldn't have had to lie. But remember, Rahab was a very much baby believer. She had had no teaching, but she had just observed what was happening in the world and realized this must be the real God. You know, God does not require perfection before someone can turn to Him. And God did not approve of her being a prostitute either. You can be sure of that. Remember that we never put some example of what someone did above scriptural statements that command us whether to do this or that. I mean, after all, David was described as a man after God's own heart, and he did some very bad things. Do you see what it really involves? Do we approach scripture saying God has the answer, and we are diligent about seeking His face and being obedient to Him in all details, or are we looking for loopholes to sort of make us feel good about doing certain things that we prefer under certain circumstances? And so this account of Joshua chapter 2 is instructive to us. It's not just a story of two men who were spying out the land and an innkeeper who was preserved when the city was attacked. It is an interesting account. At the same time, it is instructive to us. For next time, and I don't know exactly when it's going to be, but I want you to study chapter 3 and chapter 4, because this is the part about crossing the Jordan. So we'll take the next two chapters together.